calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Seven clear pointers to failure. Seven clear pointers to failure, the U.S. ignoring. Hey, greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. The beginning of our Wednesday program. We really got whacked here in the Pacific Northwest, I'll tell you. Seattle shut down, Portland shut down. The funniest videos I get, you know, tragically funny on the internet. One of the most viewed videos is this guy in Portland bouncing his car off. Boing, 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 boing. Louise drove in this morning, and it's the roads are all just solid ice. This is from somebody. I grew up in Michigan. You know, I was born there. I grew up in Michigan. Lived in the mountains of New Hampshire. Lived in the mountains of Vermont. Lived in the mountains of Germany. I know how to drive on snow. And I can tell you, people in Portland don't. It's just amazing to watch. People think that because they have four-wheel drive. Anyway, Louise and I spent the night in the hotel across the street from the radio station here. And but Higgins is well. Louise got home this morning to feed him, so he is well. And the other cats. But Nouri al-Maliki, maybe not. The Prime Minister of Iraq. Every single one of these things has been reported. We have discussed all of these things in the past, each uniquely, not just on this program, but they've been reported in the mainstream media. None of these are secrets. I mean, this is just the foundational stuff. And yet, nobody is putting this together. Now, I have not seen anybody put this thing together until Brown and Maddox wrote a piece in the Times Online. This is the Times of London, timesonline.co.uk. .uk. The Times of London, sort of the New York Times of the UK, even though it's owned by Rupert Murdoch. And he points out that it may well be, if you look at this stuff in aggregate, that Nouri al-Maliki is not our guy and is not, I mean, that he's Iran's guy. And this might be the basis for why we're hearing all this rhetoric out of the Bush administration that sort of suggests that maybe Maliki should be replaced. And frankly, there's a lot of guessing that his replacement might even be, you know, one of the guys who was feeding all this phony information into the Pentagon, Ahmed Chalabi, way back when. So anyhow, back before Christmas, Maliki invites a whole bunch of Iranian officials to Baghdad. We arrested them, you'll recall. And then Maliki says, "You got to I invited these guys. You've got to let them go." And then he says, okay, you know, Saddam Hussein has been convicted. We're going to execute him. The U.S. says, let's slow this down a little bit. No. And then there's the mocking and the video of it and all this kind of stuff is inflaming the region. In November, this is back before Christmas, we put up roadblocks. Remember we had a soldier kidnapped near Sadr City? We put up roadblocks to try and track him. He comes in and he says, you guys have to lift your roadblocks. Not going to happen. On October 24th, when Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador, and General George Casey, the coalition commander, announced with Bush's backing a new timetable for quelling the violence. Emphasis on the word timetable. Al-Maliki comes out and says, there's no timetable. We never signed up for such a thing. And back on October 25th, U.S. and Iraqi forces raided Sadr City, the stronghold of the militia led by the radical Shia Muqtada al-Sadr, whom the U.S. blames for persecuting Sunnis and destabilizing Iraq. Al-Maliki disavowed the operation, saying he had not been consulted and this will not happen again. This will not be repeated. And then when U.S. forces embedded with Iraqi forces have urged them to crack down on the Shia militias and to prevent the slaughter of Sunnis, al-Maliki has overruled them. And then finally, when Israel made their incursion into southern Lebanon this last summer, you will recall Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and al-Maliki got together in Tehran and condemned Israel for this. Now, you know, I I thought it was dumb that Israel did it, and particularly the way that they did it. But the point is that this is al-Maliki on our side or on the Shia side? Is this all about, and is the Shia side our side? I mean, you know, at what point? How do you break this thing down? Michael Slackman in today's New York Times put together what I thought was a brilliant analysis. And when you juxtapose it with a piece that Harold Meyerson did in the Washington Post today, like Nixon or like Ike, it really brings a whole lot of things into clear view that I think really hadn't been noticed by many of us before. Slackman talks about how the botched hanging of Saddam Hussein and his two lieutenants in Iraq by the Shiite-led government, emphasis on that, has caused a schism between Sunnis and Shia across the Middle East that didn't by and large really exist before. There was a relatively peaceful coexistence, and you know there are every one of the Sunni dominated countries, Saudi Arabia for example, has a Shia minority. There have been some tensions, but nothing like what's happening now. And what they're saying is that a pan-Muslim unity that surged after the summer war between Israel and Hezbollah is waning. And what's happening is the Shia and the Sunnis are starting to have at it against each other. In other words, the micro civil war that we're seeing in Iraq, the battle between Sunnis and Shia in Iraq, is at the verge of becoming a macro regional war throughout the Middle East. Emad Gad, GAD, a specialist in international relations at the Al Abram Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Cairo, he's, of course, talking about Egypt, but he's also talking about the overall situation. He says this in Slackman's piece in the New York Times. He says, the reality of the current situation is that we are approaching an open Sunni-Shiite conflict in the region, and Egypt will also be a part of it. As part of the Sunni access, no one will be able to avoid or escape it. I've been rhetorically asking the question on this program now for about a year. Is there a Archduke Ferdinand moment, a World War I moment, you know, where a seemingly small event triggers a whole series of interlocking agreements, or in this case, interlocking associations, that leads to a larger regional meltdown? This changing dynamic in the region, writes Slackman, has also been encouraged by Sunni-led governments like those in Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. And he gives an example of Mr. Abdullah. This is a guy, your average Egyptian, right? He's a farmer, Sunni Muslim. And after Israel invaded Lebanon, he puts up a picture of Sheikh Nasrallah, the Hezbollah guy, because he stood up to Israel, right? So it's like Sunnis and Shia, Arabs united, Muslims united, actually, against Israel and the United States. But now he's taking down this picture of Nasrallah because he's a Sunni and Nasrallah's a Shia. In other words, what we're seeing, this is kind of the micro to the macro. This is an example of how at the level of the individual farmer in Egypt, Shia and Sunni are beginning to become more conscious of whether they're Shia or Sunni than of whether they're Muslim versus Christians or Jews, or the West versus the East, or the ancient versus the modern, or any of that stuff. As Slackman writes in the New York Times, he says, some of the region's Sunni-led governments and religious leaders, now get this, the Sunni-led governments use the hanging of Mr. Hussein on a Sunni-Muslim holy day as a weapon in the jockeying for regional power. Who is doing this? Well, for example, Egypt. Egypt, keep in mind, Sunnis are, most of the Islamic world is Sunni. And he notes, the gathering conflict is being stoked by a determination by Sunni leaders to preserve or reinvigorate their waning influence in the region, while emboldened Shiites have pressed for more influence. And this is where it gets really interesting. Egypt has a satellite TV service. It's called Nilasat, on a network called Al Zawra. And this is the Egyptian government, right? Our ally. They are broadcasting quoting again Slackman in today's New York Times, heroic footage of the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, American soldiers being killed and wounded, and unflattering images of Shiite leaders. Same thing in Saudi Arabia. In December, the top religious leader close to the Saudi royal family, Abdul Rahman al-Badak, said that Shiites, whom he called rejectionists, were worse than Jews or Christians. So we're seeing the region come apart, and it's a coming apart that's even much bigger than are you with us or against us with regard to America. 17 minutes past the hour.
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion that we want them to be friends. They prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. I guess in summary, what I'm suggesting here is that the egg is broken. It's broken, or it's breaking very, very rapidly. This is the question Jim Lehrer asked George Bush last night, the night before last. Is this egg broken? Right, Iraq. Is this something? Are we at a Humpty Dumpty moment? And, you know, sending more American troops in, yeah, what's that going to do? What does that have to do with Sunnis versus Shia? This is spreading across the region. When you're seeing in Egypt, state-run television, running pictures of American soldiers being killed by noble Sunni insurgents, because Egypt is a Sunni country. And presumably they're a little concerned about the fact that we've put a Shia. The Shia majority in Iraq elected a Shia as prime minister of Iraq, and this guy has invited Iranians in and has gone to Tehran and has had meetings with Ahmadinejad, red carpet treatment, and somehow we just kind of don't notice that. And that's not to say that we should be getting rid of him. I mean, I'm not saying al-Maliki is like the bad guy. What I'm pointing out is that we've created an absolute mess. We broke the egg. Bush has broken the egg. And what is he going to do? He wants to throw more American troops at it. I don't think he has any idea what's really going on there. How can you, quote, win, end quote? I mean, the only way to shut down that region would be to do what the British tried to do back during the colonial era, which is you put in so many soldiers, and they ended up having to have, you know, the Gurkhas, they ended up having to basically bring in mercenary armies, hire soldiers from India and other third world countries. The French did the same thing, the French Foreign Legion. You have to bring in so many soldiers that basically, you know, every block has a soldier on it as a local cop. And it's not good. It doesn't work. Over time, it doesn't work. Even that doesn't work. Which brings me to the point of the great struggle that Republicans are now facing. And Harold Meyerson just laid this out brilliantly in the Washington Post today. He says, the Republican Party is facing, this is my language, not his, but this is the point that he makes. The Republican Party is facing a decision. They're going to have to decide whether they're going to go down the road that Eisenhower went down when he became president with the Korean War and the New Deal. Eisenhower, a Republican, the Republican Party committed to destroying the New Deal. I mean, they still are, right?
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, so there you go. Roosevelt is dead. So Eisenhower comes into office, and he could split America. He could divide America. He could go to war against the New Deal, and he could blame Korea, which was an incredibly unpopular war. Harry Truman's popularity ratings were down near where Bush's are now. He could have blamed it on the Democrats. Instead, he did neither. He ended the war. He united America. And he even, you know, came right out and said that any Republican who tries to roll back the New Deal is going to consign the Republican Party to permanent minority status, to quote Meyerson. I mean, he's just like, basically, who would be stupid enough to do that? The American people like this thing, this Social Security, this job security, the idea of unemployment insurance, minimum wage. I mean, the American people like these things. Who would be crazy enough? Eisenhower said, who would be crazy enough to go after this? Nixon, on the other hand, Eisenhower's vice president. Nixon was all about creating schisms, is the divide and conquer strategy. This goes all the way back to ancient Rome. This is nothing new. But Nixon was all about this divide and conquer. Put people, try to make your opposition look as crazy as possible. Nixon deliberately provoked anti-war protesters in order to make them seem more extreme so that his supporters, so that people who would not otherwise be extreme supporters of Nixon would become extreme supporters of Nixon because they felt that they had to go as far to the right with Nixon as they perceived Nixon's opponents were going to the left. So Meyerson notes a Nixonian perspective and now acknowledges that the war can't be won, but believes that blame for the defeat can still somehow be placed on the Democrats. If only the Democrats could be held responsible for defunding the troops. If only the U.S. presence in Iraq could be prolonged until it falls to the next administration, which may be Democratic, to end it. If only the surge engenders some wild and crazy anti-war demonstrations, then maybe, just maybe, there's a way to keep the war going without destroying the GOP. And this is the big challenge. And I would submit to you that there are some Republicans in the Republican Party who very much want to go down the Nixon road. John McCain leading the charge, and obviously Bush, the neocons and the cons. And there are some Republicans inside the Republican Party who are saying, let's go the Nixon way. And maybe even the old president of the voting machine company, Chuck Hagel. But, you know, we're going to have to see how it shakes out. And what he suggests is, if you want to know which way the party's going to fall, watch Fox. Roger Ailes used to work for Nixon and helped put together this strategy of dividing America. And Meyerson in today's Washington Post says, watch Fox. You'll see, you know, where it's going to go. Our number, 866-440-8466, 28 minutes past the hour. Look at us, we're building homes. All the people push and pull by. Let's just go out and ride. Talk about the things we tried. Look at us, we're building homes. And we'll welcome back to the real free speech zone. No RNC pass required, no barbed wire. We won't drag you off if you have a no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car, like those other free speech zones. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 35 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman program. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. Just click live chat. It's up in the middle of the top of the page there. Ajax in Wisconsin on the line. Hey, Ajax, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I just wanted to first off thank Nova AM Radio for streaming you over the Internet and allowing me to listen to you today.
Me too.
And, Tom, I've just got a couple points I want to bring up. One is, wasn't Al Maliki, didn't he become Prime Minister of Iraq through an internal democratic Iraqi process?
By and large, yes. We helped organize the Constitution that defined who was going to run the country. Frankly, if it had been an entirely democratic process, there would be no Sunnis in the government at all, and no Kurds. It would be entirely Shia, and it would have aligned itself with Iran overnight. That's why Paul Bremer didn't want there to be elections. But Sistani shoved him down his throat, so they came up with this kind of thing. Well, okay, we'll have, you know, it's a, but yeah, it was a democratic process.
Well, doesn't that, I mean, it's going to kind of play into my second point, and doesn't that just show the complete misunderstanding and incompetence of the Bush foreign policy towards the Middle East?
Yeah, absolutely. That's my point from the very beginning, is that the Bush administration and the neocons had no idea what they were getting into. They see the world through the lens of our culture, not through the lens of the cultures that they want to invade. They think that it's just a matter of, if you take down the government, everything else goes with it. Like in Germany, if you took out Hitler, all the German people would go, oh, well, you know, we no longer have a leader. Okay, you know, we need to rebuild our That's been a Western society for thousands of years. This is a different type of society. This is tribal and clan structure and sectarian affiliations and allegiances. that have very, very little to do with the idea of a nation state. In fact, the nation state of Iraq only came into being after World War One, when the British took three separate and disparate former states in the Ottoman Empire, part of Kurdistan in the north, the Sunni region in the center, and the Shia region in the south, and jammed them together and said, we've got a country, we're going to call it Iraq. And the British did that, you know, because they figured, hey, there's some oil here. And, so it's the sins of the British imperialists coming back to haunt us. Absolutely spot on right, Ajax. Thank you very much. Richard in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Richard.
Yes, I was interested to discuss about when the general from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Gates were in front of the Senate, the general said that our special forces were interrupting the flow of arms and munitions from both Syria and Iran inside of Iraq. Obviously, the senator was trying to, pinpoint whether they planned on attacking Iran and the source of those munitions. If this is true, that we are intercepting munitions from Syria and Iran inside of Iraq, what's the point of having our men going into the city of Baghdad when we can starve them out of munitions and stuff just by staying outside in the desert? This is not like Vietnam. You can pinpoint someone attacking you in the desert and be out of range and still be in the country. And at the same time, we could be, instead of going down to South America to get volunteers by giving away United States
citizenship. Yeah. No, I get your point, Richard, and it raises two interesting questions. The first is, are we so incompetent that if weapons are being brought into the country to be used against us, we can't simply, drop a bomb on the convoy and take them out, or whatever. I mean, put up a roadblock. I mean, it's not like there's thousands and thousands of roads across that desert, number one. And number two, the larger question, frankly, that I think that it raises, that is not being discussed in the American media and should be, is that Iran and Iraq are allies right now. The Prime Minister of Iraq was invited to Iran and was given a red carpet treatment. The President of Iran has been invited to Iraq. They have signed cooperation agreements. It may well be that there are weapons coming from Iran to Iraq to give to the Iraqi army that is saving us money or something. I mean, we just don't know. It's like this entire thing is like an onion. You peel off a layer and gee, there's another layer underneath, and there's another layer underneath that one. And we just don't know. What I can say with some certainty is that Iran is going to be the one vilified. And Iran is the next war that these guys want to have. And the Shias across the Middle East are seeing this increasingly not as a war on Islam, but as a war on Shia Islam. And the Sunnis, oddly enough, across the Middle East are seeing this as a war on Sunni Islam because, we've essentially given control of Iraq to the Shias. And that's the big problem right now, is that schism that is happening. Richard, thank you for the call. Dan in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick observation and a point. Today, I heard Cheney saying that since day one that the president of Iran has had this Armageddon policy, and right. He kept referring to that. And it seems that if Bush is born again, I think somebody needs to ask him if he's pointing to the Bible. Does he believe in the Armageddon too, and do they have a self-fulfilling prophecy? Because they've really created a powder keg here in the Middle East.
Yeah.
My other point is,
let me just say, Dan, to the best of my knowledge, nobody's asked George Bush that question straight up, but we do know that there are people who work in the White House who do hold to that belief that we are living in the last days, and that bringing about the final war in the Middle East would be a good thing.
Yeah, that's his legacy. Maybe that's how he hopes to redeem his legacy.
He thinks that's how he'll redeem his soul. Who knows?
Right. A lot of times in the past, Democrats have been, the Republicans want to say they're weak on foreign policy. But people like Clinton and Gore were for the amendment of the Partial Test Ban Treaty and the Non-Proliferation Treaty and heading these things off. There wouldn't be a problem that Bush keeps pointing to. So what I think needs to come back in the debate is the whole reason Democrats for all these years, and some Republicans were saying that we need to amend the partial test ban treaty and have a nonproliferation, is to stop these despots from getting nuclear
weapons. Oh, absolutely. And it even goes beyond that. Now you've got India, which is not even, it refuses to sign the nuclear nonproliferation treaty. And Bush goes over and says, okay, we're gonna give them nuclear technology. And isn't it great? We're going to get some mangoes. Dan, thanks for the call. Alan, driving to Missouri. Hey, Al.
Is that me, Cal?
That's you, Al.
Hey,
you're on the air.
My name's Cal.
Cal, I'm sorry.
That's all right. You got the 20,000 troops or so probably going in. I don't know. Is that definite now or what?
Well, the problem is, what's coming out now is that the military's not sure where they're going to put these people. They're not sure how they're going to feed them. They're not sure how they're going to get gasoline to them. And one really interesting little note in the paper today, and I'd have to... trying to find this. It's in one of my stacks here. One really interesting little note is that yesterday David Walker, the comptroller of the currency, was testifying before Congress, and he was asked, you know, the amount of money that the Bush administration has asked for to go along with this surge, does it have any relationship to 20,000 people? And he was like, no, it's a whole lot more than you would need to put 20,000 people into that area. And, you know, nobody followed up with the question why he doesn't. Obviously, David Walker doesn't have the answer. I think the answer is that the surge is a phony. This is a phony thing. What this is prepositioning of troops in preparation for the invasion of Iran. That's you know, I'm absolutely convinced that that's what's happening and that that's what's going to come down. Al, thanks a lot for the call. Bill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bill.
How you doing, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I was just wondering, maybe look at it from another way. Maybe this is exactly what they're planning. Maybe they want to inflame the area so bad that the Democrats will pull them out. They'll go to war. We'll be able to sell weapons to both sides.
Then
the whole area will fall apart.
Yeah, there are certainly some
Democrats,
people.
Then we'll be able to move back in and manage the area better.
Yeah, there are certainly some people who are who believe in that. Peter DeFazio, this Congressman Peter DeFazio, this morning referred to it as the neocon hyper confusion hyper confusion or something like that policy that you throw all the cards in the air and hope that they all land sorted out red and black or whatever. It's Bill Kristol, the Weekly Standard, saying talking about Gates as being pathetic because it's not enough warmongering going on here. I mean, there are some people who want this to get even worse. And frankly, I think that Bush right now wants it to get a whole lot worse, particularly in Iran, to divert attention away from the disaster that is Iraq. I do, however, think that in the very beginning that, they did not plan for the follow-up on this war. There was absolutely no planning. There was no plan B. There was no plan for the occupation because these guys are ideologues. They believe their own PR. They actually believe that if you just take over a country, overthrow the government, and leave it to multinational corporations, all good things will come out of that. And, they're lovers of multinational corporations, and we're finding out that that doesn't work. Al in Merritt Island, Florida. Al, got to take a break in about a minute. What's up?
Okay. I think you answered the question about the buildup. This is really a diversion. But if the buildup is true and what they plan to do, when you leave little bits of U.S. troops all around Baghdad to keep it all clean once you've cleaned it up, what happens to the people that you pushed out? They're going to be raising hell in the rest of the country.
Oh, sure. I mean, here's the bottom line. You kill people. They have relatives. They get angry. I mean, it's not that you don't pacify a country by going in and killing people. And here we have, tens of thousands at the very least, possibly hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who are dead. And they're not blaming Iran for this. And they're not blaming Saudi Arabia for this. And they're certainly not blaming Osama bin Laden for it. They're blaming us. I mean, we started out by dropping bombs on them, remember? George Bush looking at the camera saying, I'd like to speak to the Iraqi people.
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And then the bombs began to fall, and all the folks in Iraq started putting 2 + 2 together. 866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 46 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Well, at least some of us Americans do. Welcome back to the radio support group, Up by Four. We, the people of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman radio program. Bush has lost another one. Let's see, Rand Beers. There was several who several of these guys who were counterterrorism officials. Richard Clark, who have essentially turned their back on the White House. Now Todd Hinnon. counterterrorism advisor in the National Security Council staff. He's not just leaving. He's going to go help Biden investigate the Bushies. Oh, man. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Marty in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Marty.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? I'd like to get your opinion on something as to why we continue to listen to a so-called expert like Bill Kristol, why he even has any pedestal whatsoever to speak from. This is the guy, apparently, I believe there's a very well-known quote, slash infamous quote, where Bill Kristol said that there really was no antagonism, deep-rooted antagonism, between the Sunnis and the Shiites in Iraq.
We continue to listen to him for the same reason that Glenn Beck is on Headline News, for the same reason that if you turn on the Sunday talk shows, the talking head shows, Tim Russert and whatnot, you're going to find a disproportionate number of Republicans and conservatives because they represent the interests that represent the financial interests that essentially control the media in this country and control the economy in this country. And I would say this to a large extent, are controlling the war in this country. I'm not putting that forward as some sort of wacky conspiracy theory. I mean, look at the numbers.
It's exactly right. And the amazing thing is how ironic and hypocritical that in private industry, which these guys tout as their God, one mistake like that, a much lesser mistake, would get someone fired. Yet these guys continue to have made so many huge errors. You can point to, you know, from weapons of mass destruction to Al-Qaeda's.
Well, this is, hang on just a second, Marty. This is where you have to ask the question, are these errors? Or are these successes? Because if what they wanted was the war, and if what they wanted was for the price of oil to go up, and if what they wanted was for the defense, the CEOs of the nation's largest defense contractors to cumulatively, and this is, I think, just 27 men, to have taken over $1 billion in salaries and compensation since this war started. If that's the outcome that you wanted, that's the outcome that they got. It's very much the outcome that they got. And the big media with their war banners, threaten Iraq. I mean, these guys, they love wars because, you know, hey, it brings eyeballs, it sells newspapers. And again, this is nothing new. William Randolph Hearst did this, you know, in collusion with McKinley back in 1898, and before that, for the Spanish-American War. You know, you give me a war, I'll sell it for you in the newspapers. So you have to ask yourself: did these guys screw up, or did they do exactly what they were supposed to do, or was it a little bit of both? History, I guess, will tell us. Maria in Seattle, thank you for the call. Maria in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Maria.
Hi, Tom. You are so good with history. I just wanted to ask a question that's been bugging me for some time, and that is, given the historical safety checks that our forefathers put in place, is there anything current or past that addresses the mental faculties of the president?
Yeah, the 25th Amendment, I believe it is.
And what does it allow?
It says that the president, let me find it here. It's pretty straightforward. Whenever the president transmits to the president pro tem of his written declaration that he is unable to discharge, or here's section four, when the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments, in other words, the majority of the cabinet, or any other body, like the majority of the House or the majority of the Senate,
mm-hmm.
If they transmit to the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker a written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers. And then they've got 21 days basically to hold a trial. This is all about competency. And the problem is that if you were to declare Bush, if you were to try to use this mechanism to declare Bush insane, which is what to a large extent what the 25th Amendment is about, then change the guy who immediately takes over.
Yeah, and they're both insane.
and exactly. That's even scarier. Frankly, I think that what we need to do is we need to have the investigations that will lead to the revealing of the clear crimes of both Bush and Cheney, and then a prosecution at the impeachment, the indictment in the House of Representatives, a prosecution in the Senate, the removal from office, and let's get this country back on track and move forward, rather than using a kind of back around the back door technique of saying, oh, these guys are just nuts. I don't think it's gonna work. Maria, thank you for the call, though. John in Los Angeles. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Good, what's up?
Okay, so what I find very confusing about this four-year or five-year wars that we've been going through with Afghanistan and Iraq is this. Where is Osama bin Laden?
Yeah, he's in Pakistan in all probability.
What?
He's hanging out with our good buddies in Pakistan. I mean, that's the, you know, pretty much the consensus. Even Bush will tell you that.
But the thing is that's who engineered the attack on the World Trade Center in the beginning.
That's conventional wisdom, yep.
And that's what started this whole thing, so-called war on terror.
Yep.
And I thought that first that we were supposed to go after the perpetrator.
Yeah. Bin Laden was a useful idiot. Bin Laden was the guy who was the MacGuffin, you know, to use old movie terminology. He was the guy, he was the guy to blame it on. But really what they wanted, I mean, this goes back to the project that Rumsfeld and Cheney put together in the 70s, the Committee for the Present Danger, which tried to trump up, and that didn't try to, successfully trumped up what was going on with the Soviet Union, proclaiming that the Soviet Union was more of a threat to us than they were, that they had secret submarines that we knew nothing about. Rumsfeld coming out and saying, no, it was Cheney coming out and saying there are secret submarines that the Soviets have, and they are so secret that we can't find proof of them. The CIA says, we have no evidence of these submarines. Cheney says, see, I told you so. Turns out there were no submarines. We discovered when the Cold War, you know, ended. And this is the same thing. It is whipping up fear in order to achieve power and make money. And the tragedy is that lives are lost. The tragedy is that the gates of hell have been opened in the Middle East. And if Bush has his way, it's going to get worse, not better. The tragedy of it is that America's reputation is being tarnished around the world. The tragedy of it is that we are dehumanizing, in our minds, which dehumanizes us to a certain extent, huge sectors of the world's population. That's the tragedy. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So you've been hearing my take on this and my guess about what's going on and why and how and where. Let's get another perspective here. Michael Payne is with us. He's with TakeAStandMinistries.org. TakeAStandMinistries.org. An independent reporter. He's been an embedded reporter with U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, and was spent also several weeks embedded with the Israeli Defense Forces. Was that in the southern Lebanon by any chance, Michael?
Northern Israel.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. Welcome to the program, by the way.
Thanks for having me back on.
You suggest the continued criticizing and calling for troop withdrawal now has actually encouraged the enemy and given them the incentive to step up efforts to kill our soldiers and Iraqis at a vicious rate to break America's will. Who is the enemy?
Well, Al-Qaeda, I guess. Iran is involved in this, feeding trained military advisors into those who are involved in the terrorist activities in Iraq.
Doesn't Don Rumsfeld, I realize he's no longer the Secretary of Defense, but wasn't Don Rumsfeld's position the last time that he testified before Congress about this that fewer than 5%, possibly fewer than 3% of all the attacks against Americans were coming from non-indigenous sources, that is from non-Iraqis?
Well,
I mean, in other words, all those folks that you just described as the enemy constitute less than 5% of the people who are shooting at us.
Well, that, you know, I wasn't among the that element. What I was among was the American troops, and what I'm saying to you is past history of even Vietnam. General Gap said that they were within 2 weeks of surrendering and giving up, giving up the effort to overthrow the government of South Vietnam, and due to all of the media coverage back home and the dissension that was going on about the war effort and the anti-war demonstrations, that they were encouraged to continue forth, and since that, they therefore, it's well known that they won the war. So
yeah, I think General Gap either was incoherent or had his head someplace it definitely shouldn't be. I mean, all you have to do is look at what happened with the French in Vietnam to know, you know, what happened with us in Vietnam. All you have to do is look at what happened with the British in Iraq to see what's happening with us in Iraq. I mean, the fact of the matter is, Michael, I believe, let me do a reality check here. If Canada and Mexico, invaded the United States, decided George Bush is an insane guy, the majority of the American people don't support him, we're going to liberate the Americans from this crazy administration. And they invaded the United States and said that they were taking down the U.S. government and they were going to evict George Bush from office and put him on trial for war crimes. I would be out in the streets with a gun trying to repel the Mexicans and the Canadians. Wouldn't you?
Certainly. And,
okay, then how do you think that you and I in that position are any different from the average Iraqi right now looking at our soldiers?
Well, let me tell you that as I was out on the street among the Iraqis, at least 175 different missions in the total of 6 months that I have been embedded with the U.S. forces, both in Iraq, around Baghdad, in Baghdad, out in the Sunni Triangle, into Afghanistan along the Pesh River Valley, among the Afghan people, 75 to 80% of the people, and I gauge this by the reactions of their children running towards the Humvees as we would be rolling down the streets or the roads, and running and laughing and waving at us indicates to me that if they were back home and their parents were speaking hate and anger towards the American troops, their reaction to us would have been different. There are, again,
So you think these people are just loving the fact that we're occupying their country?
No, nobody's loving the situation, but what I'm saying to you is the average, most of the average Iraqi people know that we are not like Saddam Hussein.
Why are they shooting at us then?
Only some of them are shooting at us. Not every Iraqi shoots at us.
There have been several polls done in Iraq, including one done by the Iraqi government itself, that have found that between 65 and 85% of Iraqis agree with the statement, it is okay, in fact, it's a good idea to shoot at Americans.
I can't speak to polls because I also understand how polls can be worded and twisted.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The ultimate poll is that we've got 3,000 dead soldiers and 40,000 people who've had arms and legs blown off. Isn't that a bit of a poll?
And we had 3,000 people killed on 9/11 in 2001.
And that had what to do with Iraq?
Sir, are you going to let me talk or are you going to over-talk me?
Well, occasionally conversation involves interrupting each other. I've allowed you to interrupt me a few times, and I would expect you'd give me the same respect.
Well, I also will give you the same respect. I haven't been interrupting you. The fact of it is there are people who are out there in Iraq and in Iran and even Saudi Arabia and in Jordan now, Zarqawi came out of there, one of the most vicious that we finally eliminated last year. There are many people out there that are intent upon bringing this nation down, and Democrat or Republican, they won't care. It will be the same for all of us.
I think you're just starting, and no offense, I mean, I really honestly don't mean this as, it's going to sound rough, but I think you're startlingly ignorant of the history of the situation. Osama bin Laden never came after us, assuming that everything he said is true, and everything that the 9/11 Commission said is true. He never came after us because he wanted to bring down America. He came after us because he wanted us to stop supporting the Saudi government, which he considered to be corrupt, and to get American soldiers out of Saudi Arabia, which he considered defiling the Holy Land. It had nothing to do with America being hated by these guys. It had to do with them saying, leave us the hell alone.
Country did you just mention he wants us out of because we were defiling the Holy Land?
Saudi Arabia. In 1998, Osama bin Laden said, and it was in the New York Times, and this isn't a secret, he said that if we didn't take, because in 1991, Bush Sr. positioned U.S. soldiers for the very first time at Prince Bandar Air Force Base, I believe it's called. He said, if you don't take those U.S. soldiers where you've got men drinking alcohol and you've got women running around with their elbows showing driving cars and defiling the Holy Land, this is a country where they can cut your head off for carrying a Bible. He said, if you don't get those people out of our country, we're going to come and we're going to hurt you. And he did.
Okay, well,
it has nothing to do with they hate America. It has to do with they hate the fact that we're in their backyard.
I watched a video clip by an Islamic group, Radical, in New York City that was taped where they were demonstrating on the sidewalk, ripping up the flag and declaring that they were going to bring the government of this nation, this country down, and that they would occupy the White House. Now, to some, that would seem impossible and an irrational statement.
You know, Tim McVeigh was saying the same thing, Michael. I can show you videotapes of right-wing Christian groups who are saying the same thing.
I am not a paranoid right-winger, sir.
No, I understand that, Michael. What my point is, either one of us can find crackpots on the other side.
Well, again, it goes back to you don't consider the threat that you think if we pull out of Iraq, they're just going to walk off and there's going to be no more attacks against us, correct?
Yes.
Well, number one,
to put it very simply, yes. I believe that they're more concerned with their own internal politics and getting on with life than they are with trying to hop on a plane and fly to New York City and try to figure out how to hurt us. Yes, I believe that.
I believe the first tower attack was before 1998, which is the year that you quoted about us being in Saudi Arabia.
And we tracked that guy down. We threw his ass in jail.
Okay, well.
And he's still there.
He's not the only one out there. And the people in... the terrorists in Iraq are not the only ones out there.
And Sheikh Abdul Rahman, who did that first attack against the 9/11 towers, the bomb in the basement, that was all about the Muslim Brotherhood. That was all about our supporting Mubarak in Egypt. I mean, this again is about our supporting corrupt dictators, for lack of a better word, in the Middle East. This is people opposed to our foreign policy, not hating America, hating what America is doing. Why don't we change our foreign policy? We can't shove our foreign policy down their throats with a barrel of a gun. It's not going to work any better in Iraq than it did in Vietnam.
Well, the truth of it is the morale of the soldiers in Iraq, which is what the story I'm bringing back to you. My situation and my passion is for soldiers. I'm not here to tell you that. I'm not here trying to run our government. All I'm saying to you is the morale of the soldiers is good. 80% of them are dedicated to doing what they're doing, and they're dedicated to helping the people of Iraq be able to walk the streets and get an education and have clean drinking water to drink and have medical facilities they can go to.
The Associated Press is reporting this morning that for the first time a majority of the soldiers question whether it's even possible to win the war.
Well, I would say to you about the Associated Press, they have blemished themselves with their credibility many times, and the last one that's being debated right now is their anonymous sources in the administration of Iraq that they were quoting, and now they cannot produce who that was.
We have to wrap it up. Michael Payne, takeastandministries.org. You can read all about it. Michael, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. 21 minutes past the hour. It's coming down to it for the Republicans. It's coming down to it. By the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com, click live chat. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. What it's coming, and if you'd like to call Congress, if you'd like to call your member of Congress and tell them that you support things like Peter DeFazio is introducing a piece of legislation, I believe that, actually, I'm not sure exactly how many other folks are signed on to it. I won't toss a number out at this moment, but Peter DeFazio is introducing legislation saying that in the House, if Bush wants to invade Iran, he has to get permission first from the House of Representatives and from Congress, from the House and the Senate. If you want to support that kind of thing, toll-free Congress, 866-220-0044. Looks like Joe Biden is going to be putting something forward like this, too, in the Senate. This resolution probably tomorrow. We'll see. You know, maybe as late as early next week, but probably tomorrow. And the Republicans are going to have to decide which side they're going to come down on this. And I'm telling you, there's a battle going on right now. Not so much for the hearts and minds of Americans, but for the hearts and minds of Republicans. It's Bill Kristol on Fox News, Chris Wallace asking him, first of all.
President's language in his speech on Wednesday could not have been stronger. He said that this is a struggle.
And my computer is running really slow. Sorry about that. Anyhow, Bill Kristol going on about how, you know, we've... Here's what he said. He said, we may be able to begin drawing down
the war on terror and our safety.
Yeah, I'm not going to run it now. He says, we may be able to begin drawing down some of our troops later this year. He says, that's the absolute wrong message to send. The message we should be sending over there is that we're coming in. We're coming in big. We're staying. We're winning this war. Yeah, right. Please tell me when that worked. I mean, maybe the Mexican-American War, when we took Southern California and New Mexico and Arizona, but and part of Texas, I guess. I mean, I'm not a scholar of the Mexican-American War, but basically, I mean, if you're going to take property, it better be contiguous with your own country so that you can defend it, you can populate it, you can fill it up with your own folks. Empire doesn't work anymore. It never really worked in the first place. The British proved that. I mean, there's no shortage of proof for that. Dave in L.A. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just one comment on that, on William Crystal. This is the problem I have with William Crystal and the rest of the neocons is that they weren't elected. They were, and they're not accountable. They come in like bad business consultants, give their advice, and if the plan doesn't work out, there's no recourse.
but they've got a plan B if you just pay them for another week's worth of their time.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think maybe, I said you had a constitutional lawyer on when one of your substitutes was on, and I half a tongue-in-cheek had mentioned at that time, maybe we ought to use this new law removing habeas corpus at the end for one good purpose and round these guys up.
Yeah.
I mean, but there's no, like I say, no accountability. They're not acting on the public's motivation. And when their plans fail, which this one clearly has, that there's no recourse for them whatsoever. They just go off on their merry way.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point and well said. Jeff, and thank you for the call. Jeff in Winchester, Virginia. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing? First-time caller. I just wanted to bring up two things about Bush's troop buildup plan. And first off, saying that I couldn't disagree with it more, but it was brilliant on somebody's part. And I'd say somebody's because it obviously wasn't Bush's idea. But
he stole it from McCain. It was McCain's political play for the Republican. You know, there was no way that McCain could lose, right?
Right.
I mean, because you know, if there wasn't enough, he'd say it wasn't enough, and if it didn't happen, he could say, see, I told you so. It would have worked if they'd done it. And so Bush stole it from McCain.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Number one, the timing. You know, it conveniently came during the first 100 hours when the Democrats were, you know, pushing through all the successful legislation and really, you know, letting the voters speak for the first
time. Steal the headlines.
This is
Karl Rove 101. I mean, this is just basically Karl Rove 101. Yes, excellent point. Thank you, Jeff, for the call. Alex in Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, Alex.
Hi. I just wanted to know, is it possible that Bush could dissolve Congress and cancel the elections?
I believe that there are several presidential directives that have been issued over the years, in particular starting with Nixon, that may allow for that. Yes, I think that technically it's possible. Whether he could actually pull it off, I consider it really unlikely. I mean, we had elections, we had Congress through the Civil War. We have a long history of putting up with a lot of... We had, in the War of 1812, the United States was invaded by Canada and England. They got to the White House, and they burned the White House as Dolly Madison is fleeing with that picture of George Washington that's hanging in there, one of the few pieces of art that survived. And they burned the White House! And James Madison didn't say, oh, we need to dissolve Congress, we need to suspend elections, we need to do away with habeas corpus. No, we've been in much worse times, and frankly, I think that there's enough in our DNA, Alex. I think that there's enough democracy deep down inside all Americans, Republican, Democratic, conservative, liberal, whatever, you know, the neocons, libertarians, socialists. What I think there's enough democracy in our DNA that we would not tolerate that, and that's the delicate line that Bush is trying to walk. Whether he can defy Congress with investigations, though, it's a whole other thing. 28 minutes past the hour.
Everybody's trying to get filthy rich off of somebody else's money. Grandma worked her whole life sewing at a shirt factory. She was saving for retirement. She had to take a little out every week. But then a big man, a bed of high rise, he cast in his options and run. Well, he took all her money, and buddy, that ain't funny. My granny's work will never be done.
Boom, boom.
So 'cause everybody's trying to get filthy rich off of somebody else's money.
And welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Fair and slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio. Supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen for the sponsors, particularly on our local, your local sponsors, on your local affiliates. That's how you let folks know that you're supporting Progressive Talk Radio. And also, of course, our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com, and Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Richard in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom. How are you this morning?
I am just fine, but I will get better. What's up?
You know, your guest had on earlier, I didn't catch the whole conversation, but for him not to have known about nationalism and bin Laden wanting us out of Saudi Arabia, he's either an ideologue, very untruthful, or very unknowledgeable, because I think just about everybody knew that.
Well, that was the point that I tried to make to him without insulting him, was to say, you know, sir, you're missing a little bit of history here. And I think he genuinely was missing it. I don't think that he was trying to lie to us. And this is the tragedy. I mean, you look at, you know, the majority of people who watch Fox News still think that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11.
Exactly.
I mean, you got these people who are just profoundly misinformed, and they're running around all over the media speaking as if. And not speaking specifically of our guest, but, you know, just this whole bunch of them running around saying, here's the truth, and it's got no relationship to the truth.
Yeah, I talk to people all the time. I drive professionally, and it's just amazing how uninformed the American public is. It's just, I haven't always been informed myself, but it amazes me that even Democrats, they think the Democratic Party is just like the Republican Party, and I can't understand it.
Well, to some extent it is, and that's why we need to take it over. I mean, the people,
right.
You know, historically, and thank you, Richard, for the call. Historically, people, you know, I'll say, you know, get involved with the Democratic Party or vote for this guy or, you know, what, and people say, wait a minute, are you supporting the Democratic Party? No, that's not it. I'm calling for something far more radical than supporting the Democratic Party. I'm calling for the infiltration of the Democratic Party. We have to become the Democratic Party. Because frankly, the Republican Party's already taken. It's taken by the crazies and the neocons. The Democratic Party, it's available. It's available. It's amazing. You show up at these local meetings, local Democratic Party meetings, and very often you'll find four, five, six people there. My book, Screwed, the last chapter is about stories of three different people who just showed up at Democratic Party meetings and said, looks like if I got enough friends here, I could take this thing over. And we could do something with it. And they did. Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to, as an aside, just say I think the Republican Party is dying, and it probably could use some new life, but that's not what I really called it.
Well, I agree with you. And in fact, I wrote a piece about 2 years ago for Common Dreams called Republicans, Please Take Back Your Party. And my hope is that people of goodwill will take back both parties, frankly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was just wondering if, this Obama-Hillary race is just sort of a straw man race to distract us.
For me, it's a distraction, frankly, and that's why I don't talk about it very much on this program. At this point, yeah, you know, it's electoral politics, but there's two ways to look at politics in the United States. One way is, how is it going to affect you and me? In other words, what are the issues? How is it going to affect the world? Is this going to make the world a safer place or a less safe place? Are we going to advance world peace or retard world peace? Are we going to move and strengthen the middle class forward, or are we going to wipe out the middle class? What's the economic agenda? Are we going to have national health care? That's one way to look at politics. That's the way I look at politics, which is, let's deal with the specific issues. The other way to look at politics is, it's sports. It's the way, you know, an old sportscaster would look at it. Ah, it's my team versus your team, and it could be my team this week, it'll be your team next week. This is my team, and my team can do no wrong. And I'm sorry, I don't see politics as sports. I think it does a disservice to democracy to deal with politics as sports. And about 80% of the commentary that I'm hearing, particularly on network television, particularly on cable television, talking heads and cable TV, is politics as sports. And they're playing the Hillary Obama thing right now as sports. And I'm just, that's why I don't get into it.
And you don't think they're pushing it for any other reason?
No, I think they're, you know, they think that, well, see, sports is very popular with Americans. You know, there's a lot of people who the depth of their understanding of politics
is
at the level
two?
Of sports. Pardon?
Why is it specifically those two?
Well, because they're famous.
I mean, a woman and a black man, neither of which have been able to gain the presidency, battling it out for something that probably neither of them will be able to get. It just seems sort of an odd display.
Yeah, I don't see this as some kind of a conspiracy on the part of the media to push on the Democratic Party candidates who can't win, if that's the point that you're trying to suggest. I think that it's the same reason that people talk about Tom Cruise. You know, it's the same reason that people are talking about, you know, what's Brad Pitt up to this week. You know, Logan, it's celebrity and sports. And you know, there's a place for it. And I think we just spent like 3 minutes on it, and that's enough for this hour. Thank you very much for the call, though. I appreciate it. Zeph in Burbank, California. You're live and on the air. Hey, Zeph.
Tom, hi. It's a great show.
Thank you.
I'm glad I discovered you. You are brilliant. You're moving up to number one in my book.
Thank you, Tom.
When you start talking about and connecting the dots on why Bin Laden hates us, et cetera, you're right on. But you have to mention that the first Persian Gulf War was a manipulation of Saddam Hussein into attacking Kuwait.
Right, April Gillespie
exactly.
There.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that gave Bush Sr. the excuse to go into Saudi Arabia, which immediately made Osama bin Laden angry at us.
Well, that was half of it. The other half of it was the public relations company in Washington, D.C. that was hired by the Kuwaitis, and the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador going on television and going before Congress and telling the absolute plain old flat-out lie that they were taking babies out of incubators when, in fact, she hadn't been there, and, in fact, they weren't doing that.
And until Saddam Hussein was manipulated into attacking Kuwait, or at least he thought we were on his side, he was working for George Bush Sr.
Yep.
The American public is so ill-informed. Tom, you have got to actually up your listenership.
I'm working on it, Zeph. We picked up three new affiliates in the last 4 weeks. So it's, you know, step by step, one at a time here. Zeph, I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Lonnie in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Lonnie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, bravo to everything that's been said today. It encourages me to keep on keeping on listening to your show. But one of the things that's occurred to me over the weekend, I read in the Wall Street Journal, the 265 immigrants that were scooped up in December have been held.
You're talking about the Swift meatpacking?
Yeah, the immigration raid. You know, they were all shipped to different detention centers. And what has our country come to when a court has to order now Homeland Security to tell their families where they're at?
Yeah, this is wrong.
This is part of the switching bait. Like, we're all talking about Iraq and Iran, and we know that no matter what, they are going to, in one form or another, through Israel or whatever, they're going to bomb Iran. It's a given. They're not leaving office without that. But in the meantime, at home, we're being quiet while people are being shipped around the poorest of the poor, who have really zero rights in our country. They're being shipped around the country, and their families are being held in terror by not knowing where they're at and what's going on with them.
I agree, and we're not being quiet about it on this program, I'll tell you, Lonnie.
Thank you for
raising hell about that on a regular basis.
I think people need to pay attention to what's going on here. Our loss of rights in this country is severe, and I don't think we're dealing with your words encourage me to keep on as an American, because I think the neocon, the Dick Cheney's agenda has infiltrated, like Chris just said, we're going to infiltrate from within, and I think that's precisely what they've done.
Sure. Yeah, go back and read the Project for a New American Century. It's all right.
Very frightening, and I'm afraid that we may not have elections in 08. And
no, I'm not so concerned about that. What I'm more concerned about is, you know, whipping up another war, polarizing America, splitting America down the middle. The Nixon strategy being played out by Roger Ailes and just a whole bunch of them all over again. Lonnie, thank you for the call. Jack in Orange County, New York. I'm told that you're going to disagree with me, so you go to the front of the line.
Hello, I want to know what's the Democrat strategy on about Iraq?
I'm sorry?
They have plans. What is his plan about Iraq?
The Democrats' plan for Iraq?
They're only against Bush.
Is your point that the Democrats don't have a plan? Is this I know that this is the favorite talking point of the Republicans. First of all, why should the Democrats have a plan to solve Bush's war? Okay. Why should the Democrats have a plan to solve the mess that George Bush created?
The Democrats are not organized enough.
Why should the Democrats have a plan to solve the mess that George Bush made?
Because if they want to be take back the presidency, there has to be another kind of Bush. Who says that it will be the same Bush?
Yeah, well, actually, that's a reasonably good point, Jack. And you will find that the Democrats have had plans about Iraq from the get-go. The first plan was, don't do it. This is stupid. This is insane what you're doing, Mr. Bush. And then Jack Murtha coming along saying, he very specifically laid it out, very specifically, let's redeploy beyond the horizon and you know, start getting our people out of there. Now you got Joe Biden saying, let's balkanize the region, let's break Iraq up into three areas. There's a variety of Democratic plans. Ultimately, we need an American plan. And we're definitely not getting that from the Bush administration and from the Republicans. Well, all of the Republicans. Now we've got, it's coming out that Chuck Hagel, I guess, has deserted the Bush administration. 46 minutes past the hour. I do believe there's a dream for everyone. This is our country. There's room enough here for science to live. And there's room enough here for religion to forgive and try to understand. And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy in the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., an accredited White House reporter and congressional reporter. Victoria, Chuck Hagel has defected from the Republican war machine.
He's a naughty boy.
Yeah, he hasn't left the Republican Party. In fact, in my opinion, I've been saying this for 3 years, ever since I first learned that he was the former president of the company that became ES&S Voting Machine Company, and that he got elected on his own voting machines in Nebraska, and had Charlie Matulka, the guy who ran against him on this program, claiming that Hagel rigged the election and stole it. Ever since then, I've been saying, okay, this is the guy that the Republicans are going to run for president. He knows how to run the voting machines. It looks like maybe my conspiracy theory is right.
Oh, gosh, it's deep, man.
But whether he's running for president or not, what has he done?
Well, what he's done is he's spoken out against the president in an extremely forceful way in a committee hearing last week, which was extremely public. And there were other Republicans who were doing so, but he was the most vocal and he was the most direct.
And now he's signed on to this resolution.
Right, and in signing on to this resolution, he's broken completely with his party.
Mm-hmm.
And, there may be others who are going to do so, but he's broken completely with his party, and he's thrown his lot in with the Democrats in what can only be described as a very bold move.
There's an interesting op-ed in today's Washington Post suggesting that the debate within the Republican Party is between, with regard to, you know, how do they go forward, how do they position themselves, and how do they deal with the war, is to either take the Eisenhower strategy or the Nixon strategy. The Nixon strategy is to divide the nation, to try to further inflame and radicalize the Democrats and those who are the opponents of the war, so that it further inflames and radicalizes those on the right and the Republicans who are loyal to, in the case of Nixon, in the case of Bush, Bush, and use that wedge to maintain power. The Eisenhower strategy, remembering that in 1952, when Eisenhower became president of the United States, Harry Truman was incredibly unpopular, the Korean War was incredibly unpopular, and the New Deal had just happened, and the Republican Party was committed to destroying the New Deal. And Eisenhower said, number one, he's not going to take down the New Deal. He thought that was a crazy idea because it was so popular, and he wasn't going to go after it. And number two, he ended the war in Korea without blaming the Democrats and without blaming Harry Truman for it. And he could have very easily done that. And so they're suggesting that this debate is, are the Republicans going to take the Eisenhower strategy and basically be statesmen and resolve the situation in the Middle East and not try to pin blame on anybody, but let's just do what's best for the country and for the world? Or are the Republicans going to go down the road that Nixon went down, which is, you know, personal power at all costs? And the writer in Washington Post suggests that Roger Ailes is going to be the litmus test. He's, you know, watch Fox News and you'll find out. What do you think?
Well, that wouldn't surprise me, as a matter of fact. If you watch Fox News, you might find out. I think we're at a very different place in history from 50, 60 years ago. And I think it's a more complicated, difficult place where if you want to behave like a gentleman and not blame the other party, it's made more difficult for you to do so. So.
And yet that's what Chuck Hagel is doing.
Right. That's what Chuck Hagel is doing. But if the majority of the Republican Party, for example, wanted to go one route and not blame the Democrats, I think it would be difficult. I think they find it difficult to do so because there is a radical wing, a radical powerful wing within the Republican Party, which is at the moment in power within the White House, which wouldn't permit that.
So. It's going to be interesting to watch how this shakes out because I am skeptical as to how much longer that radical wing will hold power on the one hand. On the other hand, I'm very wary or worried or concerned about what they will do to hold power. You know, a cornered rat is far more dangerous than a rat under any other circumstances. And I think that we have a couple of cornered rats here in the White House to extend the metaphor perhaps farther than it should be, but nonetheless.
Well, I don't know, rats.
Yeah. You know, in Germany, in German, the word for a government building is the rat house.
No.
Honest to God, R-A-T-H-A-U-S, rat house, yeah.
That's perfect.
That's, yeah, it is. It's just, you know, when I first moved to Germany, I was like, somebody said, oh, you got to go to the rat house to get your driver's license. And I'm like, the what? The rat house. Oh, it's a government building. Yes. Oh, yes. So, you know, maybe we should be a little more candid here. We have about a minute here before we have to wrap up the program. What else is going on in Washington, D.C. right now, Victoria
Jones?
There's
a big thing going on in Washington, D.C., which is the bring-your-own-popcorn, if you can get in, which you can't. The second day of the Scooter Libby trial, the second day to try and seat a jury, where you've got 9-1 or 10-1 Democrats to Republicans registered in the city of Washington, D.C., in the district, and they're coming up against people who are already saying, I can't find anything good to say about this administration.
But what does that have to do with whether or not the guy lied?
Well, they really are finding it that people are pretty much saying that they would find it very difficult to be unbiased. So far, it's going very, very slowly. They do have a few people for the panel. As of about an hour ago, they had 19 people.
People who are either A, brain dead, or B, liars.
Well,
I mean, how could you not have an opinion about this for this administration?
You're starting to think, they've got some people who do have opinions about the administration, but not necessarily people saying flat out, I can't stand them.
I see. So they're, yeah, okay, interesting. So it's, well, we'll see how it shakes up. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always good talking with you. 56 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour. With a Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, microchip tags. May I see your papers, please? No, may I see your microchip, please? Larry Scott with VA Watchdog will be with us, and we'll be back with your calls and more news of the day. Stick around. Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group of by and for we the people of the United States of America, 7 minutes past the hour. You know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, sometimes you don't even know what you don't know that you don't know, and sometimes that's the most dangerous.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
And think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Can it be? Our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, by the way, sponsored by LiberalStore.com. All things liberal in bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Check out the liberal teddy bear there at liberalstore.com. Our Everything You Know Is Wrong guest, Henry Vandergriff, mobresistance.org, the website. Hey, Henry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Great. Over at your website, there is a piece of video here. This is Joe Biden talking to John Roberts.
a microscopic tag being planted in a person's body to track his every movement. There's actual discussion about that. You will rule on that, mark my words, before your tenure is over. Can brain scans be used to determine whether a person is inclined toward criminality or violent behavior? You will rule on that.
So, what's the deal here?
Tom, there has been a movement on ever since the mid-1980s where they're basically going to identify every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth with a microchip in their body. I had the opportunity to interview Joseph Woodland for IBM, and he was the guy who invented the barcode, and that's that little universal product code that's on all the products when we go to the grocery stores.
Sure.
And I asked him at that time in 1992, what are y'all doing to try to identify human beings? And he said, whereas that was called the universal product code, he said, I was now referring to the universal personal identification code. And he said that unique to every man and woman's body is certain biometric identifiers, and he gave me some examples.
Well, the easy example is thumbprints or fingerprints.
That's right.
Iris scans, another one. There's DNA. You know, blood type is an old-fashioned one. It's more general. But my understanding is that the Real ID Act, which has already been passed, it was attached to one of the big budget bills last year, requires that within a certain number of years, as I recall, it's 5 years, all the driver's licenses in the United States have to have RFID chips in them. Right now, they're putting them in our passports.
Correct.
Once we have the RFID chips in our driver's license and in our passports, if any of us show up at, say, a rally or a demonstration or a protest or whatever, all they have to do is drive by, you know, with a helicopter or a car and a scanner, and boom, they instantly know everybody who's there, where they live, what their credit history is, everything. You walk into a store, they can scan you, they know everything about you. Why do they have to go to the additional step of implanting this in our body?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'd be all for it if they were just using our fingerprints. But the fact that they're using a microchip in our bodies, and that's an excellent question. I don't know the answer to that. The system is not fraud-proof without the biometrics, and they have to have your biometrics.
Mm.
And for whatever reason, and this is the fascinating thing for me, this microchipping, which was originally invented in early 1980s for the cattle industry here in America.
Sure, and they're using it right now widely, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. And then it was developed for dogs and cats at your veterinarians.
Yep, and they're promoting that.
It's the same identical technology.
Yeah.
And now they're wanting to use it in human beings.
Well, and I've seen, you know, two fluff pieces on TV where they're like, you know, put one of these chips in your kids so that you can track them down. Where does this stop? First of all, how do you respond to the folks in America, particularly those who are in the biochip industry, I suppose, who say, oh, but this is a good thing. You know, if you ever get lost, we'll be able to find you. If you forget your credit card, you can just wave your hand in front of the scanner.
Right. Well, my thought on it is that, look, this is not about privacy, and it's not about, you know, protecting us, although all of those things is what they're saying, you know, that they can protect us. It's really more about control, because once they know everything about you and profile you, and this is what Joseph Biden is talking about, that they are literally talking about a cradle-to-grave database on every human being so that they know who you have dinner with at night, what kind of magazines you read. Are you reading magazines about certain types of religions? Are you reading hobby magazines about certain guns and explosives? Are you in the chemical engineering field? They begin to profile you based on who you're hanging out with.
But they're already
doing that. They make assumptions about you.
But Henry Vandergriff, MOBresistance.org, they're already doing that. And it even goes beyond that. I mean, today the ACLU is releasing the result of a Freedom of Information Act filing against the Department of Defense, and they found that they're spying, the Army, in violation of federal law, is spying on American citizens who have nothing to do with international terrorism for, quote, anti-military behavior, end quote, as I recall. And what that means is they showed up at protests.
Right. Yeah, and again, the thing is about control. It's not about liberty or freedom or protection of citizens. It's really about control.
So how do they control us if they know everything about us? What is it, that one day suddenly you discover that your credit cards don't work?
Well, isn't that an ominous thought, you know, the fact that, they've profiled you and decided you're not a very good citizen. And so as a result, one day you walk into a grocery store and you've got a basket load of groceries and suddenly you realize your chip does not work when you get up there to buy and pay for your groceries. That would have tremendous conscientious persuasion to you as an individual that you're going to cooperate with the government.
But they can do that already with your credit card.
Well, that's true, but at least
and in fact they do. They,
as those, of at the moment, you can
that,
pull
they
cash.
Do. I mean, there was an attorney up in Washington State, as I recall, who they mistakenly thought that he had something to do with this bombing in Spain, and boom, you know, they froze all his accounts. He's not the only one, obviously. They freeze all your bank accounts. I mean, they're already doing this.
Right. And this is exactly
shouldn't we be concerned with the fact that they're already compiling these databases and they're already putting into place laws that allow them to have this kind of control over us and not just look at the RFID chips? Might not those be almost a distraction?
Yeah, and I agree with you, Tom. And I think that Americans ought to be up in arms about this sort of thing. And I think that every good American ought to be asking his prospective presidential candidates about what Joseph Biden said, about what Capitol Hill is talking about doing to Americans, and saying, are you for this or against it? You could literally swing the election in 2008 with this very conversation.
I was a guest on a radio show, a shortwave radio show out of Colorado that was so right wing that it wasn't even right wing anymore. I don't know how it is. You know, a survivalist group. You know, one of these. Who believed that the Second Amendment was so that we could rise up against the government and all that kind of thing. And one of the areas that we found agreement on was a concern about this growing power by the government and the shared belief, I think both on the right and the left, that this is not what the founders of this country, whether they were the conservative founders like John Adams and Alexander Hamilton or the liberal founders like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, had in mind.
I agree. Absolutely.
So what do we do about it?
Well, we need to resist. That's why the website
How?
Is called Mob Resistance. Well, again, in the presidential elections, I would just say absolutely. Are you as a candidate for this technology? If so, I don't want to vote for you. I want a candidate that would say to us that he wants to restore to America freedom and liberty. It's not about being like East Germany.
Yeah.
If you remember in the former Soviet Union, people conscientiously were scared to death to voice their opinions for fear that the government would crack down on them.
Well, because the government had control of the economy, ultimately. The government decided where you lived. The government decided where you worked. And here, increasingly, the government is acquiring that power, the power to control our checking accounts, for example.
And that's exactly right. And in fact, what you're seeing in, a simple analogy, if you look on the commercials on TV, you'll see the commercial for Visa showing that, if you use cash, you're a Neanderthal and that you're holding up progress in America, that we need to get rid of cash. But cash is a legal tender and we should be allowed to use cash. But if they go to this system where you pay for and identify yourself with a microchip in your hand, then what happens is the government ultimately has control because they can shut down your chip. And boy, how powerful that is for you as an individual to say, gee, if I don't cooperate with the government, if I don't agree with the present administration, I won't be able to buy bread for my children or gas for my car.
This is right out of Revelation. Charles Stimson, the top Pentagon official overseeing U.S. detainees, has now come out and said he had said that any law firm that helped out, helped defend prisoners at Guantanamo Bay should be boycotted, should be blacklisted. He's now come out and apologized. He said those comments do not reflect my core beliefs. But isn't there this creeping kind of fascism within our government, Henry?
Absolutely. I agree with you.
Yeah, we need to stand up to this. Mobresistance.org, the website. Henry Vandergrift, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 866-440-8466. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. We'll be right back.
Someone told me long ago there's a calm before the storm. I know it's been coming for some time.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 and a half minutes for those of you who are all into precision. Larry Scott is with us. He's the chief cook and bottle washer publisher over at VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to, and that somebody is you, Larry. You're doing a fine job of it. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. I just almost had to cancel there. I've got an appointment to get my RFID chip implanted.
I love it. Louise was just saying to me, it's funny, while we were off the air, she said, the guy mentioned nobody can use cash, and you just kind of slid by that. And I said, no, I made the Revelation mention. And this is, you know, in Revelation it says...
That's 666.
Yeah, no man might buy or sell, save that he has the mark or the number of his name, you know, on his right hand or forehead. And this is one of those areas where I think that Christian conservatives are looking at the Bush administration and going, hey, wait a minute, maybe these guys aren't what they say they are.
Right, and on a less biblical level, we should probably mention, too, that the military and the VA are also experimenting with RFID chips.
You're kidding.
No, the military already has, and they're using them in the field in a lot of different places, what they call e-tags or electronic dog tags. It is basically an RFID chip that is heavily encrypted, that, you know, the old name, rank, serial number, blood type, religious preference, and medical history in there. So if someone's brought in to a surgical hospital, they can instantly scan this and find out everything they need to know about this person. So there's an advantage there.
Yeah, there's a serious upside to that, actually.
Yes, and they're also experimenting with implantables, although they're doing very few of those.
But the serious downside to it is that if one of those members of the military decides that they want to, for example, we had 50 guys today present a petition to Congress, saying, hey, wait a minute, what about, we're not all that happy about Iraq. If somebody in the military decides that they want to speak out or they want to do something that would involve whistleblowing activity, mm-hmm. they get nailed.
Yeah, and that is correct. There is up and the downside. On the VA side, too, Tom, what they want to do is they're experimenting on putting the RFID chips in your VA card. So you'll just be able to go to any VA clinic, any VA hospital, have it scanned again. It very heavily encrypted information, and they will know automatically your medications and so on and so forth, much faster than pulling up your electronic records, even though those are available.
Yeah.
So we look at the positives and we look at the negatives. And the unfortunate part is, whether it's military or civilian news, it's a very, very thin line. And once we cross that line, we've opened up a door, and we don't know what's on the other side of that door.
Well, and I think we crossed that line in the mid-1970s. You and I are old enough to remember back when it was against the law for a corporation to ask you what your Social Security number was.
Absolutely right.
It was absolutely a crime in the United States for a company to use a Social Security number as an identification.
And your credit record was your credit record.
Period. Yeah.
Right.
And nobody else had access to it.
Period. End of subject. Tell that to your car insurance company these days.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So anyhow, back to the VA.
Yes.
We only have a couple of minutes.
Okay.
Stephen Boyer did enormous damage as the Republican chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee.
He did.
You suggest now that Bob Filner and Daniel Akaka are working together to try and undo some of that damage, even though Jim Nicholson, the Republican hack, is still the secretary of the VA.
Right. Right. We have Filner and Akaka are doing some great things together. They're working through Bob Filner's new every promise kept. He wants to keep every promise going all the way back to World War II for veterans. That includes a new modern GI Bill that we've talked about, which would include tuition, books, room, board, and $1,000 a month in the pocket. They want to pass mandatory funding for VA health care, get that out of the discretionary budget. They want incredible amounts of money for mental health care for our troops coming back. They want to make what is called an absolutely seamless transition, where the troops coming off active duty, whether they be guard, reserve, or regular military components, will be able to make a smooth electronic record transition into the VA. This is something that hasn't been done, although they've talked about it for years. It's going to take money, and it will take a little bit of time. This list goes on and on and on. They have an incredible agenda. It's almost as radical as I say radical in that because these things haven't been passed, as the Nancy Pelosi 100-hour agenda. This is almost like a 100-hour agenda.
I'd say it's almost as radical as the Veterans Administration when Dwight Eisenhower was president.
Yes, as a matter of fact.
I mean, under a Republican Congress and a Republican president, it's almost as radical as it was then. I mean, it's actually worked pretty well back then.
And it's really working pretty well now, except for the funding problems. And we're finding now there's all kinds of rumbling on Capitol Hill. Is this Congress going to pass the 2007 budget, or are they going to continue with the continuing resolutions for about 10 government agencies, including the VA, and begin work directly on the 2008 budget? Right now, the VA stands to lose about $3.3 billion. That's over $9 million a day, Tom, if we don't get a current, a 2007 budget passed. They're operating at 2006 levels right now. Waiting lists are increasing. So one of the things we've been encouraging Filner and Akaka to do is to work with the budget committees. Get this budget passed. Get it passed now.
And we need to let our members of Congress know. Get the budget passed, number one. And number two, take veterans' health out of discretionary and put
That's
it into...
That's it, exactly.
Yeah. Well said. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. We'll be back with more news of the day and your calls right after this. Thanks, Larry. 28 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Pro People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You know, we today have gone through the entire spectrum. I mean, we have heard from conservatives telling us that all is well in Iraq and the Iraqis love us and we just need to, kill them all or something. We've heard from progressives pointing out that for example, Larry talking about the VA, that good things can be done by government, that the veterans hospitals actually work. We've heard from folks concerned about microchips, you know, just the whole spec. I think, though, that my biggest concern is that America, to a large extent in our media, is being acculturated to accept hate. That hate is becoming a comfortable currency for us. And, you know, without sounding like Miss Prim the librarian, this concerns me. For example, on Martin Luther King Day, another talk show host, Michael Wiener, he goes by the name of Michael Savage on the radio, went off on this rant.
But basically, if you're talking about a day like today, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and you've got to understand what civil rights has become, the con it's become in this country, it's a whole industry, it's a racket.
And then he gets into how really what the civil rights is all about is denying white guys their birthright.
It's a racket that is used to exploit primarily heterosexual Christian white males' birthright and steal from them what is their birthright and give it to people who didn't qualify for it.
Heterosexual Christian white male. This is coming from a Jewish guy, by the way. But, I mean, playing on hate, playing on fear. I guess I'll just leave it at that. I'm not going to go into a long rant about it, but I do think it is important that we point these things out, that we call these things exactly what they are. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Janice in Long Beach, California. Hey, Janice.
Hello.
Good morning or good afternoon. Whatever. Let's see, Long Beach. It's good morning. You're on the
air. Oh, yes. Hi. Barely morning.
Yeah.
It's an honor to be talking with you. I respect your knowledge and your viewpoints and your attitudes. I just wanted to ask you a question. Is it true that the Saddam execution and the following two executions were conducted on an American base?
Depends on how you define an American base. They were conducted in the Green Zone. They were conducted in a facility which Saddam used to use for executions, which was taken by the Americans. I believe that it was officially handed back to the Iraqis. It was rebuilt with American contractors. My understanding is there's a bit of a gray line between, you know, whose property it was and whose property it wasn't.
My reason for my question is that what would make us believe that we were not in control of that execution and that, in fact, those people there and those videos from those cell phones were not purposely put out by American operatives or whatever to take the blame off of the U.S. and try and further, like you said on the Nixon plan, divide and conquer the Arabs.
Well, I don't. I don't think that we need to further divide the Arabs in order to conquer them. I wouldn't go that far. We did an official video and thought that we were going to put that thing, or the, you know, Maliki did, his government did an official video which looked reasonably dignified and made all the news press service and all that. I don't think that they expected that those telephone videos were going to get out. I think it's been a disaster for both the Iraqi government and for the U.S. administration. Whether we were in control of it or not, this is an interesting thing, because about an hour ago when this topic first came up, one of the folks in the chat room said, hey, wait a minute, are you trying to tell me that the U.S. government wasn't responsible for exactly when? Because I had quoted a news report saying that the U.S., or no, a piece in the New York Times today, saying that the U.S., was reluctant to allow the execution of Saddam to happen when it did. They wanted there to be a little more due process, and it was a sunny holy day and all this kind of stuff. To the extent that the U.S. government has to, on an ongoing basis, pretend that the Iraqi government is a sovereign entity, I think that, you know, if the Iraqi government was saying, hey, give us Saddam, that they had to do it. It's that pretense, and it's a pretense that is seen through by increasingly, I think pretty much everybody in the Middle East, particularly the Sunnis, who are flipping out, who are getting very, very, you know, the Saudis. I mean, this is why the Saudis called Dick Cheney over to Saudi Arabia and said, listen, mister, you're going to get control of this situation, because if you don't, we will. And it's in today's paper that the Saudis are saying, if we don't control the Shia and start protecting the Sunnis in Iraq, they're going to send their own troops into Iraq. And I mean, we're talking now a regional war. I don't think it's conceivable that we're Machiavellian enough or crazy enough that we would have let that video out and caused that to happen. But frankly, I don't think so. Janice, thanks for the call. I got to move along here. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick. Listen to WTKJ.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to comment on this non-binding resolution. I guess has three sponsors, Senator Levin, Biden, and Hagel.
Yes, sir. This is the resolution that would require, actually it wouldn't require because it's non-binding, that would beg the president to ask Congress for permission before he attacks Iran.
Oh, so it's not even regarding the surge then? So-called surge.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. The one in the Senate is on the surge. The one in the House is on Iran, the one that Peter DeFazio put forward. You're right. I'm mixing them up. Yeah.
Of course, the two may be connected, but I was just going to say, now, I know you haven't spoken too well with Senator Hagel, but on this Iraq situation, I think he's been about the best we're going to hear from the Republican Party. He's been very critical from as far back as I can remember of the whole policy, and I don't know whether he voted.
I agree. It's amazing. There are times when I listen to Chuck Hagel and I think, you know, finally a semi-reasonable Republican. And then I go back to the fact that, you know, he was in bed with Bush Sr. for 20 years and he was the head of the voting machine company and all this stuff. And it just creeps me out. Although it's possible that people with weird histories can be very decent politicians and he might be a great statesman and he might even make a great president.
There's always a chance for a sinner's redemption, isn't there?
Yeah, I'm willing to give him that. We'll see where it goes. And also the thing, you know, like Gordon Smith right now, one of my two senators, the Republican, you know, for 6 years he's a right winger, for 4 years he's a right winger. He's up for a re-election in 2008. So all of a sudden now he comes out against the war. I'm quite cynical about Gordon Smith because we've seen this before.
Yes.
On the other hand, though, the thing that I keep preaching on this program is that we don't elect kings and we don't elect leaders in this country. We elect representatives. We want people to represent us. And if the will of the public changes in a really significant way, I believe that our quote leaders, our elected representatives, should actually change their positions.
Yes.
So to that extent, if Hagel is changing his position or Gordon Smith, I have to say, you know, yes, that's what we want to have happen. Rick, thanks for the call. Dean in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Dean.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I'm doing pretty good. I wanted to add something to your comment earlier about how we feel that we're becoming indoctrinated to become a hateful nation or to, you know, describe ourselves in feelings of hate.
And to tolerate hate, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd just also like to extend that a little bit further and consider how we view our leaders and how long has it been since a leader could go somewhere without an army of security and expect to be greeted with a loving public. And I don't see that happening, like, on a bipartisan basis. It seems like in the past, you know, you could have a leader go somewhere, be greeted by a loving crowd, and then when election time came, then we'd go back to like, okay, his time is over, let's see where we're going to vote next.
Yeah.
And there's so much hate that's prevalent, like we feel that perhaps it would be wrong to love a leader so much, because you look at somebody, and I wouldn't name a name, but there's politicians now that are coming up and that are loved by a great many people, and in the back of our minds, because of the society hate that we're living in, we start to worry about, okay, can they even go somewhere where it's unsafe for them to be, because the hate is so high.
No, I agree, and I think you can track this right back to the Nixon strategy of divide and conquer, and then to Reagan. You know, back before Roger Ailes, the fellow, I'm forgetting his name, the guy who really originally started the whole thing. Absolutely. And thank you, Dean, for the call. In fact, Dwight Eisenhower, I mean, here's a Republican running on the platform of peace. Listen to this. This is Eisenhower's campaign commercial.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower, a paid film.
You get that? He's met the leaders of Europe. He's working with them. He's talking with them. Vote for peace. I mean, do you think that somebody could run on that kind of a platform today? Dale in Nebraska. Hey, Dale. We just have about 20 seconds here.
Yeah, Tom, I always enjoy your program, but coming from the state of Nebraska, I've watched everything unfold with our very own Senator Hagel, and I think we're all naive if we believe that Mr. Hagel or Senator Hagel is able to come out with such a opposing view of the Republican Party without any kind of, shall we say, Karl Rove attacks on him.
Yeah, no, this is why I've been saying for a couple of years that they're positioning Hagel. That's why I keep thinking for 08. I keep thinking Hagel's going to be the guy who replaces Cheney.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So they've got... By the way, have you heard that Ron Paul may be putting his hat in the ring?
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Ron Paul's one of the few really honest Republicans. I have a lot of respect for him. Dale, thanks a lot for the call. Got to take a break here, but interesting. I disagree with Ron Paul on a lot of things, but I have a lot of respect for him. What more can I say? 46 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain, but don't tell Limbaugh because he'll want some.
Is there anybody here who'd like to change his clothes into a uniform? Is there anybody here who thinks they're only serving on a raging storm? Is there anybody here with glory in their eyes, loyal to the end, whose duty is to die? I want to see him. I want to wish him luck, I want to shake his hand, want to call his name, put a medal on the man.
And welcome back to the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's see, 9.5 minutes before the hour, 51 minutes past, or nearly, 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, Susan in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Susan.
Yes, hi. I had a question. Why isn't anybody watching or mentioning that the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad, or whatever his name is, was down on the 13th of this month, down in South America, making all kinds of deals with Chavez? They made a $2 billion social investment fund to strengthen, you know, their two countries. What I'm worried about is if Bush pushes buttons on Iran, why couldn't we possibly be attacked from South America? Because didn't Chavez's country buy all kinds of military equipment, big machinery?
No, actually, he's mostly buying AK-47 kind of things. But I think the way, if Chavez wants to attack us, the way that he would attack us is cut off our oil supply. We're buying an enormous amount of oil from him. I'm not concerned about a military attack from Venezuela. What I'm frankly far more concerned about is a military attack on Venezuela. You know, we meddled in that country once already. We helped a coup that overthrew Chavez and, you know, a democratically elected figure, and he came back with a huge majority in rebuttal of that. And every Venezuelan knows that the U.S. was meddling in that election. And it's ultimately, again, it gets back to, it's all about our economic interests. It's the, you know, confessions of an economic hitman story all over again. And yeah, the fact that Ahmadinejad and Chavez were together, you know, in Venezuela was fairly widely reported. But that's how I would take that, Susan. I'm not so worried about that. Thank you for the call, though. Mary in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Mary.
Oh, hi. This is probably a redundancy with you. But I'm wondering what Congress is going to do about the section in the Article 1, Section 8 that says the provision of the Constitution restricting Army appropriations to not more than 2 years is designed to keep the Army under constant congressional control and thus discourage any prospect of a military dictatorship. What do you think they're going to do about that?
Well, what they do is every year they pass a military appropriations bill. I mean, you know, it's the founders were, or the framers of the Constitution were, as you point out correctly, Mary, very, very worried about a military that would rise up and confront a government. And as was Dwight Eisenhower, frankly, you know, and his concern about the military-industrial complex. And so they put into the Constitution it even went beyond that. It says, to raise and support armies, no appropriation of money to that use shall be for longer term than 2 years. So, and this was part of the compromise that Jefferson was proposing with what became the Second Amendment, where he didn't want there to even be an army during time of peace, only a navy. And instead you'd have all these militias. Everybody would be a member of the militia. But, you know, these days it's just routine. They just pass the military appropriations bill, you know, every year or every other year in a really bad year. And by the authority of the Constitution.
It gives them the opportunity to just change the Constitution around.
No, they're not changing the Constitution. The Constitution says that the Congress must at least every 2 years redecide whether or not they're going to have a military and whether or not they're going to fund it. And what's happened is that every year since the founding of this country, the Congress has said, okay, let's have a military for another year.
Oh. You know?
So, you know, it's not like some great conspiracy or some anti-constitutional thing. The lesson for us is that what the people who put together the Constitution were very suspicious about a professional military or about a military that was separate from the people. And that's one of the reasons why that paragraph 12 of Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution is in there. And frankly, I think we should have more discussion on it, and there should be, you know, more knowledge about it. Mary, but you raise an interesting or an important point, Mary. Thank you for the call. Steve in Monterey, California. Hey, Steve.
Thanks, Tom, you doubting apostle.
Yeah, what is this?
I just want to know, when the atomic scientists reset the doomsday clock to 5 minutes,
last week, yeah.
It was on the top of the hour this morning.
Oh, it was? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Was that exclusively the result of W's belligerence, or did Blair's waffling popularity maybe figure into the equation a little?
I honestly don't know. I caught the story that they had changed it. I thought it was a few days ago, actually, but the exact rationale, I don't know. Here's the interesting thing about, you know, if you want to get into Bush and Blair, and that is that Blair leaves office in all probability in April.
We hope.
Yeah, and I think that Bush is going to try and have his war in Iran before Blair leaves, and I think that Blair would like to be out of power before Bush has his war in Iran. Yeah, there you go. So it's interesting. We'll see how it all shakes out.
No, I just wonder if we the people should be worried.
About what?
The possibility of this idiot trying to initiate a situation which demands martial law.
Yeah, I think we should be concerned about that. And beyond, I wouldn't say so much worried, I think we should be proactive. We should be doing something about it right now. We should be talking to our elected officials. We should be talking to calling talk radio. We should be writing letters to the editor of our newspapers. We should be joining local political parties and getting active and speaking out. Thanks for the call, Steve. Coming up tomorrow's program, Republican presidential candidate John Cox is here. He's worried that no human embryo is safe from Nancy Pelosi. I'll calm him down. And Jonathan Moreno from the Center for American Progress on an important stem cell discovery. That and the news of the day and your calls here on the Tom Hartmann radio program. And remember, my friends, democracy and activism begin with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann program. Check our website at www.